Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth. Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sexting, sex bracelets, sex parties, 21st century teenagers are out of control. Or are they? Kathleen Bogle is co-author of Kids Gone Wild, and she argues that kids these days are actually less promiscuous than they were 10, 20, even 30 years ago. Kathleen is a sociologist at LaSalle University. And Kathleen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's dive right into these horror stories. What are some of the big ones floating around the internet and on the media?
Well, sex bracelets was one of the ones that traveled the furthest, really, literally all over the world. So the sex bracelet story was that kids were wearing these gel bracelets of different colors, and the legend goes that the colors actually secretly stand for sex acts, and if someone snaps the bracelet off, you have to do whatever sex act corresponds with the color. And red meant lap dance, black meant intercourse, or depending upon who you asked, the color and the sex meaning would change.
So the sex bracelet is one thing, the rainbow party, sexting, pregnancy packs. Let's parse the fact from the fiction. Which are real and which are urban legends?
Well, sexting is real. Sexting was really happening. We still kind of present the issue as potentially being hyped, especially considering people were suggesting that we arrest teens and put them in jail as sex offenders because of sexting. What research actually shows is the most common sexting scenario is that two teens who are dating and involved with each other, one sends a sexually provocative picture to the other. And that can often be the end of the story. Where it ends up making news is if, you know, the teens end up breaking up and the disgruntled party ends up sending the picture out and the picture gets wide circulation. And so the question came up, well, what do we do if that happens? And because there's so much hype over teen sexual behavior, people say, well, we have to, you know, crack down on this. We have to lock them up. We have to register them as sex offenders because they thought we hit some point of no return where we had to take drastic measures.
We do get the message that teen sex is just out of control. But what about the numbers? Are kids more sexually active than they have been in the past?
Believe it or not, they're less according to national data. So the Centers for Disease Control tracks youth sexual behavior. There's actually something called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. If you look at, for example, the percent of high school students who have ever had intercourse, in 1991, 54% had had intercourse. By 2011, it had dropped to 47%. And that same pattern of a, not a drastic drop, but a significant drop, we see in almost all measures of sexual behavior. So the percent of teens that have had more than four sexual partners, the percent of teens that have had engaged in oral sex, all those kind of things, we see staying constant or decreasing a bit.
How about teen pregnancies?
Teen pregnancy has dropped significantly since the early 1990s by almost 40%. So it's one of the biggest success stories in public health is a drop in teen pregnancy. Well, now, that's not to say we're not still having issues with that, that there aren't thousands of people getting pregnant, but it's on the decline, not increasing, as we've been led to believe.
Why are news outlets so eager to report on teenage sexual behavior?
Well, I think, you know, the idea that sex sells has been around for a long time. But I think what the news media does is they don't just, you know, try to sell the sexual story, but they're trying to sell fear also. If you look at some of the quotes we have where we look at the introductions to stories on sex bracelets or rainbow parties or sexting, it's always like, parents, you need to listen. Parents, you need to sit down. You need to prepare yourself. We're going to tell you that your child is doing things that you cannot believe, that you don't know about, that's putting them at risk. So they're really selling a kind of fear-mongering and this idea that their kid, their precious kid, is at risk and that they're not aware of it and they're missing the boat and they better tune into that story to see what's going on.
Kathleen Bogle is with us. She is co-author with Joel Best of a new book called Kids Gone Wild, From Rainbow Parties to Sexting, Understanding the Hype Over Teen Sex. Well, many of these stories that we do hear, there's this almost fear of teenage girls. What is this revealing about the nature of the hype? Inherent sexism in the media or what?
I think there's definitely a fear that the character and morality of girls have changed. So if you look historically in the U.S., the, you know, female was supposed to play the gatekeeper role. She was supposed to say no and turn down the advances that guys might put forth. And I think part of the fear and part of where these legends get traction is that, well, maybe they're not going to turn them down. And maybe they're going to be the ones that are the aggressors. A show that I watch on CBS, The Good Wife, did an episode where they had a female character that was very aggressive towards the son of the main character. And, you know, so she's playing this very aggressive high school student, and they showed her arm being filled with sex bracelets. And they didn't even explain what they were. She just kind of showed the arm of bracelets and said, you know, I'm completing my political education. And the implication was she was trying to sleep with all these kids of political figures. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting with these stories is over time, you don't even need to explain them anymore. They become what we call like a cultural touchstone, where everyone just knows what a sex bracelet is. Everyone just knows what a rainbow party is. And you can just make a passing reference to it, and people kind of nod as if, yeah, the kids today are insane. They've gone crazy, and they're doing all these things that previous generations would have never done.
Shouldn't we be concerned over some of these behaviors, like sexting, for example, and the shaming that often comes with it?
Well, I do think that there are things to be concerned about, and my co-author and I aren't saying that there isn't. The issue is whether we have such a hyped view of things that when it comes to an issue like sexting, do we handle it the right way? So one way to think about the sexting issue is, you know, how do we get people to be smart about what they post and what they make public and what they send to one another? How do we criminalize if people are publicly sharing something that was supposed to be a private message? But that's not what happened. In some of the cases, they were taking girls that were barely teens, you know, 13 years old, and trying to charge them, trying to say they were sex offenders for sending a picture of themselves in a bra to a guy they liked or to their boyfriend. So, you know, the idea that we would register them as sex offenders the way we would a pedophile for doing that seems to me to be very out of whack.
Is this just something that comes up generation by generation? I mean, we think in the 20s, it was the flappers. There was Reefer Madness. There was Elvis Presley's hips, you know, Free Love, drugs and disco in the 70s, Stranger Danger in the 80s. Is this just a new manifestation of that fear?
I think it is to some extent. We talk about that. We lay out the history in the book about, you know, people were once concerned about going steady and what that meant. They were concerned about lipstick and miniskirts. And like you said, Elvis Presley and what that meant. So there's always a tendency to look at the young and become concerned about what they're doing. But if it just stopped at concern, it would be one thing. But like I said, it creeps over into policy, and not just regarding sexting, but when the public discussion over Plan B birth control was laced with quotes about, you know, teens gone wild, the public discussion and government debate over Gardasil vaccine and whether young people should get it. We don't want people making policy decisions based on a warped idea about what young people are supposedly doing.
So there's some payoff to stories about kids being out of control for various different interests.
Yeah, what's interesting is it can be very opposite interests. So feminists can take up one of these issues and say, look, young women are being exploited. They're being tricked into going to rainbow parties. They're being tricked into sexting and then exposed when a ex-boyfriend forwards the picture. So feminists can take it up. But then conservatives can, on the other side of the aisle, take up the issue and say, look at the morality of youth. The youth are behaving in ways that previous generations wouldn't. This is a sign of moral decay and a decrease in family values. So the very same topic, opposite sides of the aisle take it up and show that it's evidence of what their concern is, what their agenda is.
Those are representing ideologies, but there must be some payoff for society and culture to embrace these messages, even if they're scary. I mean, we seem to gobble them up. How does it serve the rest of us?
Well, I think when you look at urban legends in general, the whole idea of urban legends is that they are based on some sort of underlying fear. So we have a fear today about the sexualization of youth, the sexualization of childhood, that kids are growing up too fast, that they're being exposed to things that previous generations weren't. And we look at these public figures like Lindsay Lohan and Britney Spears and Paris Hilton and Miley Cyrus, and we say, oh no, youth are going to go the same way they are. They're going to pattern their behavior after them. And what's interesting is there just isn't evidence to support that. At the very same time we're concerned about all of that, as we talked about earlier, we see trends where behavior has gotten a little more conservative in terms of sexual behavior. Less people are sexually active in high school than they were 20 years ago. So imagine telling parents, you know, that, oh, no, it was actually your generation that was more sexually active than the current one you're so worried about. They would never believe it. And I can say for a fact that they would never believe it, because when I tell people about this research I've done and this book I've done, they're very reluctant to buy into it. They say, well, you know, you must be missing something. Or if I tell them, well, no, things aren't out of control sexually. I've had someone say back to me, well, what about drugs? They're worse with drugs than ever, aren't they? So there's this tendency to believe that the younger generation is worse than ever. And if you tell them something to the contrary, they don't want to believe it. But you put the headline out there that says kids gone wild. You put an Oprah episode that said, is your child leading a double life? And they buy it hook, line, and sinker.
Kathleen Bogle, thank you for helping us cut through the hype.
Thanks for having me.
Kathleen Bogle is Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Justice at LaSalle University and co-author with Joel Best of Kids Gone Wild. You'll find a link to more on the book on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And up next, we're going to hear from a teen about the real-world consequences of sexting and why she believes sexual cyberbullying has become the modern-day equivalent of the scarlet letter for teenage girls. That story when Word of Mouth continues on NHPR.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. These days, many teenagers live half of their lives on social media sites, and they are writing the rules as they go. One online trend 16-year-old radio rookie Temetayo Fagbenle finds disturbing is something she calls slut-shaming, or using photos and videos to turn a girl's private life inside out.
Back in 17th century Puritan times, shaming women like Hester Prynne for their wanton acts was a whole town effort.
Hester Prynne, you have been found guilty of adultery.
I was 10 when I read The Scarlet Letter.
Has she no shame?
Hester was cast out of the community and forced to wear red letter A for adultery.
It would be better if they put the brand of the hot iron on her. That she could not hide.
Slut-shaming like this has been going on for centuries, but now there's a new tool. Instead of shaming hussies in the town square, there are thousands of Facebook and web pages literally called Exposing Hoes. So there's this photo on Facebook of this girl. She's laying down on her bed. She seems to be half naked. All she had on was a white t-shirt. And the board tagged her in the picture so everybody could go to her page. This picture was put up 43 minutes ago, and it already has 443 likes and 261 comments. People post pictures and videos and make smut lists for their neighborhood or school. I'm just gonna read some of the comments now. Your life is officially shot, LMAO. One boy put, I think she gonna cut her veins when she see this. As for the boy who put up the picture. The boy just actually posted a status. He said he has 2,000 friend requests because of the photo he just put up. And this is like a regular occurrence. Like, I'm sure it's gonna be pulled down. Maybe I should report it right now, but I don't know. 2 years ago, when I was in ninth grade, a girl in my class faced a similar situation. Her boyfriend put an intimate video of them up on the internet. It was the talk of the town.
He was going around holding his head high, saying, oh, well, I was able to do this with her, and he gave me a bad name. It was on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, WorldStar, everything.
So WorldStar is like the X-rated version of YouTube.
It was on WorldStar?
It was on everything.
certificates to a social media network is over for her life.
Yeah, I think that's wrong, right?
I gathered a group of girls in my school to talk about slut shaming online.
They be getting exposed, like
yesterday.
Yesterday there was some girl. She was in a picture with like a
penis in her mouth.
Yeah, smiling.
Girls often feel they need to shame other girls for their improper behavior.
Girls do it to themselves. Half the time we came and blame guys. Like, she was really looking into the camera, smiling.
She wasn't smiling.
But it's not always the girl's fault.
There's people that they don't know when they're taking the picture. There's people that don't know they're getting recorded. That's not fair that a guy can actually hide his phone, have sex with you, and record you, and then show it to his friends like, yo, look.
When I was talking to the girl this happened to, she said she didn't know she was being recorded.
I kind of had a feeling that something was wrong, but I didn't want to believe it.
Can you just, like, just walk me through the first day you came to school after it happened?
Well, I came to school hoping that it wouldn't be too big of a deal. I was walking around the school with my hood on trying to just, like, to get to class.
But even the principal already knew about the video. He brought her to his office and called her mom.
I went back to class, and like half an hour later, my mother was in the school. And I couldn't even look at my mother because I felt hurt, and I also felt like I disrespected her. And I didn't want kids in the school to look at my mother and be like, wow, she raised nothing.
I see girls get exposed on my Facebook news feed almost every day.
It was about 7th grade, and I'm in 12th grade now.
Back in middle school, this guy emailed a picture of his girlfriend without a shirt on to some of his friends. It spread around their entire school.
Did she transfer out of the school after
it happened? She stayed and continued to be the smut, smitty, slide, skip-scap, scallywap, you know, whore.
I don't want to make an assumption, because he's a friend of mine. But maybe he doesn't understand the seriousness of what he did.
So did you intend it to be malicious?
I guess I thought it would be cool or something. It took me a day to send it out. And then from a day, it just went around until it finally got back to the school and the teacher saw it.
Schools have had to take on a new role. Some students screenshot the cyberbullying they see online, print it out, and bring it to the teachers as evidence.
Can you tell me your name, please?
My name is Erica Doyle.
Erica is the assistant principal at my school.
In cases where somebody might put up a sexually explicit video, is it necessary for you to contact the authorities?
Yes, absolutely. Because once we're dealing with digital media that is sexually explicit, that has been captured and shared with the public, that actually now is a criminal matter.
I got arrested. They handcuffed me to a bench. That was pretty scary.
But most of the time, the police don't find out. Kids don't usually report it.
You said that when you decided to do it, you thought it would make you cool. So did it make you cool?
Yeah, after it happened, there was a lot of like, yeah, man, that was awesome.
You sound pretty unremorseful right now.
I regret doing it to her, but still, I didn't have to go to jail. Porn websites do it every day, so even the girls gave me props. But there was about like 1% of them that you know, that thought I did the wrong thing.
I don't typically do this, but when I saw that photo of the girl lying down on a bed without underwear, I decided to report it to Facebook as harassment.
Okay, so Facebook sent me a notification. It says,
15 minutes later, the photo was still up. Facebook said that it didn't violate their community standards. But their community standards state a strict policy against any explicitly sexual content where a minor is involved.
It now has 500 likes.
So then I reported it as pornographic content. After another 15 minutes, I got a similar message.
Content not removed. What? Why is the content not removed?
I talked to a Facebook spokesperson. She said she can't talk about specific cases, and she refused to go on record about anything to do with the issue.
Don't know what to do, and the photo's still going to be up there.
Before you yourself were affected, what did you think of girls like that, and what do you think now?
Well, I would do the same thing that happened to me. Like, I was calling them names and I was judging them. But then when it happened to me, there were situations, like, on Facebook where they'd be blowing up some other girl's spot. And I'm like, wow, she screwed up the same way I did.
Teenagers today aren't more cruel than they were in the 1600s. It's just that now when we chastise each other, everybody that has access to the internet can see it. And once that picture or video is out, you can't be completely safe in your mind that the past won't creep up on you at some random time.
I saved the pictures. I know the teachers deleted. I still have them.
This is the new Scarlet Letter.
It is now ordered that you shall wear upon your bosom for the rest of your natural life the Scarlet Letter A.
For WNYC, I'm Wiki reporter Temitayo Fagbenle.
Recapture your childlike spirit. View the world with playful eyes. Tap into the child within. From management manuals to self-help books, we're told that creativity means getting in touch with your inner child. Up next on Word of Mouth, why that advice may be doing adults and children a disservice. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the news. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's a common refrain from well-intentioned friends and self-help books alike. The answer to all our complicated adult problems can be found in our younger, childlike selves. Unhappy at work? Be like a child and do what you love. Is your creativity at a standstill? Tap into your inner child. Kids don't worry about failure, neither should you. Our memory of youth often becomes glorified the older we get, but our next guest says the reality is these sentiments do children and adults a disservice. Tasha Golden is singer and songwriter for the band Ellery. She's also a poet, and we found her essay, Stop Chasing Childlike Creativity in Plowshares. Tasha, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So you've worked with a number of those with childlike creativity, namely children, specifically six-year-old in foster care. Now, these kids, were they a font of creative energy?
they did create quite a bit. I just found that it was not this unencumbered, carefree approach to creativity that we often ascribe to children. And I most frequently work with college students or teenagers in jail, and so my friends, when I was working with very young children, assumed that I would be finding them to be this, like what you said, a font of creativity, and that just was so patently not the case that I felt it should be addressed in some way, that they were creating to overcome things just the way that adults do.
Mm. So even as young as 6 years old, kind of already burdened with something.
Yes. And I don't think, you know, my gut reaction was to say, oh, this is because maybe they're in the foster system and their lives have been in some way exceptionally difficult. But in talking with adults, I think that very few of us remember a childhood that was this sort of unencumbered, carefree, all of the imaginative license in the world at our fingertips. Very few of us actually had that experience as children, even though we might like to remember ourselves that way.
Maybe the rosy glow towards childhood is a way of making ourselves feel better, but is it actually problematic for adults to romanticize childlike creativity?
I think that the problem comes in making this dichotomy between an adult is someone who is rational and analytical, and a child is someone who is carefree and open-minded. Because not all children are that way, even children who have a relatively healthy upbringing, they have their own pressures, they have their own, they play in order to learn things, in order to master motor skills or to learn how to handle language or social interactions. And so I think that by looking at childlike play and saying that's just something that you do when you have free time and you don't have anything else to do is a means of downplaying actually the purpose of play. Hmm. And I think that the result is not that we become more creative, but that we downplay the important work that creativity does in our lives as a means of overcoming things, as a means of narrating things, as a means of working through our lives, whether we're processing and assimilating good things or negative things.
Yeah, in some ways it sounds like it discounts the difficulty that children actually face.
Right, right. And I found that a lot of times when people say, you should create like a child, I think that they really mean a very specific kind of child. They say, you should create like a child, and what they mean is you should create like an extroverted, gregarious, very carefree, supported, privileged, affirmed, confident child.
I'm seeing them in my head right now.
Yes, and even children can be very healthy and very happy without being gregarious and skipping around all the time. And I find it problematic also that we put all children in one big lump.
Well, and I wonder if it also discounts creativity in adults, you know, implying that they have harnessed some sort of childlike magic rather than working at their art or, you know, taking a life's experience and turning it into something in a way that requires thought and a little bit more than magic.
Ah, exactly. And that's what I get excited about when I work with teenagers that are incarcerated or with college students or with young children, is that I see them taking their experience, and in spite of having seen hard things, knowing hard things, they are able to envision something, whether it's redemptive or whether it's deeply troubling or just existential, like some kind of Waiting for Godot. Whatever it is processing what they've seen and been through. And I think my recent experience that I mentioned in this essay was working with foster children. The most haunting art that they created, even the youngest ones, was art that in some way spoke to their experience or articulated their experience. And I think that's what a lot of us go to art for, is to see some representation of what we know to be true. And so when we make creativity out to be at its best when it's created by people who are too innocent to know that anything difficult happens, I think that we diminish the significance of play as a way that we deal with what we encounter, what we learn as truth, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, Tasha, you're a creative person. I wonder if you have any kind of rituals or ways that you tap into creativity when feeling stuck, and does it involve anything about that kind of accessing the child?
I can't say that it involves accessing childlike creativity. I think that might be in part because I've always been such a serious person, and as a child, I took everything pretty seriously too. And maybe that's part of my response to this, all this creative advice, is that when I try to hark back to my own childhood, there wasn't this imaginative license that I can remember having. But I think that when I feel stuck creatively, the most productive things that I do is try to find something going on with my family or friends or my community or some kind of national issue that stirs me up and makes me feel like there's something that has to be said, and finding some kind of audacity to be the one to say it. Maybe the latter part is the most difficult.
Well, Tasha, thank you. You've given us a lot to think about.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tasha Golden is the singer and songwriter for the band Ellery. Her poetry has appeared in many publications, including Plowshares. That's where we found her essay, Stop Chasing Childlike Creativity. We posted a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. And we continue to tap into our creative spirit with a look at something that both children and adults can appreciate, rainbows, though maybe not the kind you're expecting. Instead, we're going to look at an audio spectrum. Maybe you already know the term white noise, but there's a whole world of different colors of noise out there. Reporter Marnie Chesterton set out to discover what they are and whether she could make them into a rainbow of sound.
Red and yellow and pink and green, orange and purple and blue. I can sing a rainbow, sing a rainbow, sing a rainbow too.
That's my colourfully named young friend Indigo, singing a rainbow. Cute, but not scientifically accurate. There's almost a rainbow of colours of noise, and I'll try and get Indigo to sing it later. Before then, let's have a look at what's out there. You'll probably be aware of white noise. It's what we call the static hiss on a television. But there's also red noise and blue noise, pink noise and violet noise. What are they, and what are they for? Meet Shelley. In her case, they're a lifesaver.
I had a 16-month-old son at the time, and I just put him down for a nap. And I went downstairs and I put my feet up, and I suddenly became aware of a really high-pitched, ringing, kind of squealing sound. which at first I thought was coming from somewhere in my house. So I got up and didn't think too much of it, walked around looking at the TV, boiler, all of these kinds of things, but I couldn't figure out, I couldn't pinpoint where it was coming from. And my husband came home not long afterwards, and I said, "Oh, can you tell me where that noise is coming from? It's just driving me spare." And he said, "What noise? I can't hear any noise." From that moment, I started to panic almost instantly. Yeah, it was just dreadful.
It took her 6 months to get a diagnosis of tinnitus. During that time, Shelley started experimenting with sonic coping strategies.
I started a course of sound therapy. A lady showed me a device that allowed me to listen to different sounds. So, for instance, it could be white noise, which is quite a gentle noise, and pink noise, which is similar to white noise, but it's got a slightly deeper tone to it. The sound of rain, the sound of thunderstorms, the ocean, any of these kinds of things. And I actually found, through my own experiments, that standing in front of the fridge when it was humming or flushing the toilet over and over again actually was neutralising the sound of the tinnitus. I remember nights getting out of my bed, laying in the fetal position, rocking backwards and forwards, crying all day, every day, forcing myself into work. I was a complete nervous wreck before I found sound therapy. I didn't think of taking my life because I've got a husband and a son to think about, but I could understand why people could end it, because it's very hard to imagine how you could live like that.
Dr. Derek Hoare is a senior research fellow at Nottingham Hearing Biomedical Research Unit in the UK, and he explained what's going on with Shelley's hearing. But first, a 101 on how our hearing works.
So the hearing system is beautifully complex, but at the same time reasonably simple. We have nerve cells in the ear called hair cells. When sound vibrations hit our ears, those hair cells move, and that essentially triggers a chain of electrical activity along the hearing pathway up to the hearing brain. In the hearing brain, we have centres that process those sounds, and that information is fed to our higher brain, into our consciousness. With tinnitus, we lose hair cells, and these cells in the ear, they don't regenerate. Once they're gone, essentially they're gone. So what you end up with is a large area of the hearing brain that's spontaneously active, and that is actually interpreted by the brain as hearing a sound.
So when your brain can't hear certain frequencies, it makes them up. It sounds odd that the consequence of hearing loss for about 10% of the population is that they hear more noise. So the solution, to fight it with yet more noise, doesn't seem that unreasonable. It goes back a long, long way.
Titus Flavius, one of the Roman emperors, he was actually said to be cursed by the gods with tinnitus. He noticed one day, walking past a blacksmith, that the sound of the hammer hitting the anvil actually masked his tinnitus really well. So he actually hired a blacksmith to come and work alongside him.
And pink, white and violet noise used by tinnitus sufferers today are the modern equivalent. But who labelled pink pink, not green or orange? In Salford, in the north of England, Professor of Acoustics and author of Sonic Wonderland, Trevor Cox, explains why these noises have a colour at all.
I guess the correspondence comes about because you're changing the balance of the colours. In the same way as if I mix every colour evenly of the rainbow, I'll get white out. So if I mix every sound together of the audible spectrum from 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz, I get white noise out. But if I decide to mix some more low frequencies, now in light that would be mixing in more red, then I'd get a nice sort of reddy, pinky sort of tinge to it. In the same way, as I mix more low frequency sound, so more bassy sound, then I would get something that people would call pink noise. It's about the analogies between the frequencies of light and the frequencies of sound and the balance between them. So blue noise has a lot more high frequencies in it, and blue colours have a lot more high frequencies in them.
I'm on a quest to find black noise, supposedly silence, although the prof points out that noise by definition can't be silence. He and I end up in a very odd room.
Can you describe where we are?
Well, we've just walked into an anechoic chamber, and what's all around you on the ceiling and the walls and on the floor are these grey foam wedges. It looked quite odd. And when I'm talking, it sounds like my ears need to pop. It all sounds very muffled, and that's because any sound going to the walls, floor, the ceiling are just absorbed. We don't hear any reflections. So this room acoustically doesn't exist.
So if we use the apparently unscientific definition of black as an absence of noise, then that could be what you hear in here.
Well, of course, the funny thing about an anechoic chamber is you don't hear nothing, and that's what surprises people, because you yourself make noise. So often people describe a hissing sound and a more low-frequency sound, and that's thought to be the nervous system and the blood moving in your head. So black noise isn't silent, it's internal sounds, probably.
Hiatus, or to use his real name, Cyrus Shahad, is an electronic musician and producer. He's also a brown noise obsessive.
I remember being a kid and waking up an hour or so every morning before I had to wake up for school and crawling downstairs and lying in front of a fan heater. Wasn't really sure why I was doing it. It was almost just this subconscious craving for what I thought was maybe the heat of the fan, but actually, looking back, I think it was the noise.
Cyrus's love for the soothing rumble of brown noise feeds into his work.
Well, I've certainly noticed that over the course of the years that I've been making music, I have at times found myself layering noise underneath what would be otherwise kind of ostensibly quite sparse piano tracks. There's something acoustically almost painful when it comes to listening to certain frequencies, the high frequencies particularly. I guess kind of at the back of my mind, I've always thought that there is a constant kind of sound to life. There's something that makes us feel more like we're kind of cradled by the planet we're on rather than just sort of bowling through this silent space. And brown noise, I think there's definitely an element of that with it. It just makes me feel a bit more reassured that life goes on around me.
And on that philosophical note, it's time to take the meandering over the rainbow and back to Indigo, who will try and recreate a sonically accurate rainbow of noise. Take it away, Indigo. Red and brown and pink and white, purple and blue. Not as pretty as the visual version, but still fun to try. Thanks to Indigo, I'm Marnie Chesterton. I have been your sonic guide. This programme is part of the PRX STEM Story Project, made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Okay, the experiments continue with word of mouth, this time with a psychology professor who conducted a bit of unofficial research in her own classroom, offering students extra credit in return for a cell phone-free environment. Did they take the bait? We'll find out when word of mouth returns after the break.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Even while we applaud the smartphone for its convenience and utility, we recognize that its constant use has had negative effects on our attention. It is not uncommon to see coworkers using devices at meetings or friends glancing at them mid-conversation. And in school, students peer at them under desks during class. Louise Katz is a professor of psychology at Columbia State Community College in Columbia, Tennessee. On a whim, she decided to offer her students extra credit in return for a phone-free environment. And she wrote about the experiment in an op-ed for the Chronicle of Higher Education called Today's Lesson, Life in the Classroom Before Cell Phones. Louise Katz, welcome to Word of Mouth.
I'm very glad to be with you today.
So how good was the deal? How much extra credit did students receive?
They received one extra credit point per class period for their participation, and the participation is always voluntary. But I've found that virtually all students participate almost every time class meets.
Wow, how do you do it? School teachers I've talked to say the kids do spy on their phones under their desks.
They do. And it's possible, you know, I don't enforce it, you know, rigorously. I take their word for it that they're bringing it up. Our classrooms generally have a large table in the front of the room, and I ask them to turn it off and put it on the table in front of the room.
So any noticeable difference once the cell phones were largely out of the picture?
Tremendous. Unbelievable difference as far as the classroom atmosphere. Just as an example, today, this morning, I had a class. Students already actually had their cell phones on the front table before I entered the room, and everybody was talking together, and it's a wonderful atmosphere, and it's very good because students are getting to know other students, which is part of what college is about. for the last few years, I was walking into classrooms that were silent, and every single student had a cell phone in front of them. And I noticed this in hallways, too. You used to walk down a hallway, and students would be in groups talking to each other. And I had noticed the last few years, the hallways were silent. Students were standing or sitting on the floor or even standing in groups, but there's hardly any talking going on. They're just looking at their cell phones. And we were talking about it in class yesterday in one of my classes, and the students were saying they feel afraid to talk to somebody in person.
Well, I'm thinking the kids in college now, they've probably had cell phones maybe even since middle school. So for them, having class before cell phones is a thing of the past. What have they said about this experiment? How did they experience it?
Well, it was really interesting. After I did it for one whole semester, which was last spring, I gave at the end of when they had finished their final exam a brief eight-question questionnaire and the opportunity to write an essay about their experience. There wasn't one student who didn't like the activity. They loved it. I was more interested in the reasons they gave. Things like their concentration was much more improved. Mm-hmm. The atmosphere in the room was completely different, which I noticed the first day I tried it. Students said, people pay attention to me when I'm talking. They said the atmosphere was a lot more respectful. And one thing that was really interesting, I was aware as a faculty member how distracting it is to be conducting a class with students on their cell phones. But I was not aware how distracting other students in the class found their classmates' use of cell phones. One student called it the distracting glow of a student playing a game. And they really were so happy that this was removed from the classroom. Some of them said things like, I've started turning it off in my other classes, even though I don't get any extra credit there.
I wonder if you get the impression that they almost would like to have a reason to shut off their phones. They just don't have one most of the time.
Definitely. Some of them actually said that explicitly in their essays. Some of them admitted in their essays that in their classes they were checking for messages every 5 minutes during the class. One student said, at least every 5 minutes. I had no idea really this was going on. In other words, I was aware that some students were looking at their phones, but I was not aware how widespread it was because they keep it under their desk in their big classes.
Wasn't this something that they should be doing anyway? I mean, giving extra credit for behavior and attention that should be expected.
Yes, and certainly we should expect it. But and I've given that a lot of thought, and I certainly gave it thought before I implemented this. The problem seems to be we can expect it and know it should be expected, but that doesn't mean it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I really liked what one of the readers of my essay wrote as a comment. He liked it because it was a choice students make rather than a rule they'll try to sneak around when possible. Cooperation rather than submission, that the students become collaborators and they make a conscious decision to give up distractions for the sake of their own success.
And that comment is something that all of us could perhaps think about. How can we volunteer to let go? Because the smartphone distraction is not just a problem in school. We see it in the office, in a meeting between parents and kids, dinner. Do you have any idea how we might change our bad habits outside of the classroom, Professor Katz? Because you're not going to be giving us extra credit.
Right. I think that's an excellent question. And I would say that the biggest thing is the experience of it. I would say to just try it and start seeing some of the benefits. One student wrote, I just feel so much more productive without it.
Louise Katz, professor of psychology at Columbia State Community College in Columbia, Tennessee. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, you'll find a link to read Louise's op-ed for the Chronicle of Higher Education. It's at wordofmouthradio.org. And we would love to hear from you, especially if you are an educator. How do you think cell phones have changed the classroom environment? Are there benefits to students having cell phones in class? And what rules have you or your school created to try and cut down on smartphone distractions? And more importantly, do they work? You can join the conversation on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there is plenty more at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we spoke with sociologist Kathleen Bogle about the realities of teenage sex. Kathleen argued that while the media may lead us to believe that 21st century kids are out of control, research indicates that teens are less promiscuous than they were 10, 20, or 30 years ago. So we'd like to hear from the parents out there. Does that ring true for you? Do you think teenagers, including yourself, were wilder back in the day? You can join our discussion on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.